Blog Talk Radio.
Scott Golden here with the Power Perception Radio Network. Welcome, welcome to those of you who are new. Welcome back to those of you who are seasoned veterans of what we do around here. Been a while since we've been here on the main channel. My schedule, as well as lining up new guests for the fall season, has taken a bit of precedence, but we're back here now, and there's plenty of stuff for you to listen to if you're interested in catching up with all that we've already done. 366 episodes as of today. For you to listen to free on demand on a variety of topics from athletes such as today, pro wrestlers, MMA fighters, to authors, musicians, spiritualists, and all points in between. You can go back in the archive, just type Power of Perception Radio Network into your Google machine. That'll give you our entire archive. You can check it out. Also, give us a follow on social media. There's two ways to do that. Scott Golden on LinkedIn, Golden Opportunities Coaching, our parent company, and on Twitter, at PO Perception. Nearly 74,000 of you across those two networks, which means we're doing something right. Dejanette will be with us in a moment, a standout in professional women's basketball, both at the high school, collegiate, and professional level. Also, an author and an entrepreneur and so much more. We're going to talk to her about a litany of things around all those things, try to educate what it takes to be an empowered woman in 2017, what would level the playing field, both literally and figuratively, and so much more. Let's merge that call now. Dejanette, are you with us?
Yes, I am, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for taking time out of what I'm sure, especially with the book on tap, is a super busy schedule. Kind of give our listeners, though, a little bit of your background so they know what we're going to discuss over the next hour or so.
Yes, yes. First off, I would like to thank God for this opportunity, and thank you for having me, Scott. My background is pretty much centered around basketball. I started playing at the age of 7, started playing organized basketball in 8th grade, around 14 years old, and since then my love has grown exponentially for the sport, and I've been involved in it, coaching, playing, now like with the book, now I run the girls basketball event, which is one of the top events in the country, and I've just enjoyed it. It's been a journey, but I've enjoyed it.
All right, and obviously we haven't always had the WNBA and other women's leagues, certainly a evolution there. What are the changes from your childhood to present day as it regards specifically women's basketball, but also sports for women in general?
Well, of course, Title IX was one of the biggest, additions for women. But the WNBA, when it came along, before it came along, actually it was the ABL. That was the professional league for women at the time. And as a young female at the time myself, that was what I aimed to want to play in. And then they started the WNBA, and it has had a great long history thus far. The women who played in it have represented it really well. And it's really allowed and have given girls an opportunity for themselves coming along, and it gives them something to strive towards. So women's basketball has really, really made some very important strides and has grown, and it's continuing to grow. You know, even with the youth, at the youth level now, girls basketball is really huge, Scott. It continues to grow.
You know, it's interesting to me. I've always been a college basketball fan, and then after college, I enjoy the women more than I do an NBA game. The reason being, the style of play and intensity of play is different. There's such a hunger on the court that we don't see in professional men's basketball that I really find intriguing. What would you say contributes to that?
I would say for the men's game, it's more of the highlights. It's the fast pace up and down. But the women's game, really shows the fundamentals of the sport. Because as we both know, women are not as naturally athletic as the guys. So therefore, our approach to the game is to focus on the fundamentals, master the fundamentals. Like even with the women's game, you see the women boxing out. You see them really using screens to get open. You see all of those basics. And even in my experience coaching, I tell young kids, I tell parents as well, watch the women's game if you want to truly learn how to play the game, because that's where you see all of those small things that matter that help make you successful as a player.
The differences I see are something more like a men's game is more for a highlight reel, whereas a woman's game is more for endurance. At least that's from an outsider, just a fan. That's the difference I see. Is that what you see as a coach as well, or is it more than that?
Yeah, it not saying the men's game don't have those fundamentals involved, but with the guys, a lot of times they can rely on their athleticism and the natural talents. Women, you know, you're not going to see dunks every game in the women's game. I mean, right now, I think the only two people that have done it that are actually playing is Candace Parker and Brittany Griner. So you're not going to see that on a regular. But on the women's game, you're going to see the purity of the sport. I mean, that's a better way of putting it. So that, you know, I would say that you're going to get the rawness, the purity, the beauty of the sport out of the women's game. The men's game, yes, it's highlights. Let's just be honest.
So going forward, you know, you said you started in about eighth grade, then you transitioned into professional. Professional, though, in your era, I'm assuming more international than a national strong league. What were the highlights, just personally and professionally, of your career, things you look back on and go, wow, I can't believe I did that?
Oh, wow, that's a great question. I have to start back in... actually, at the beginning of my high school career, because I wasn't that highly touted player coming out of eighth grade, I had a lot of potential, but it hadn't surfaced yet. So I think one of those main highlights from that point in time in my life was the fact that nobody ever expected me to start on varsity. That was the first stage. And then, of course, I guess you could say at the time I was an undersized post player at 6'1". I'm 6'2 now, so I've grown, I guess. But, you know, I had a lot of naysayers saying, hey, you'll never play Division I at that size, and et cetera, et cetera. So that was another thing that I accomplished. And then those are two of the first standout highlights, because those set the tone for everything else that I accomplished in my life. And after really getting past those obstacles, nothing else really bothered me so much. And I really set my mind on knowing that, you know, with prayer and with hard work, with dedication, I can accomplish anything once I, you know, succeeded in those aspects. So those were the early highlights. The other highlights was winning the city championship in 2000. That was huge, because I was named MVP for that game. And we beat a program that's run by Coach Dorothy Gators out of Chicago, who is, like, legendary in the high school basketball history, girls and boys. So we beat her team, and she had a long-standing history of having teams that were just unbeatable. So, you know, that was a great accomplishment. I finished that game with 20 points, 19 rebounds, so that was one of those highlights. And then going further, just being able to go play Division I basketball, have a great career, accomplish all types of accolades during that time, and then go overseas to play professionally, it really, really, like, it came full circle. And I thank God for it, because it lets me know that all of my hard work paid off. Of course, the WNBA situation didn't work out, but I can't complain, because when you go play as a professional in Europe, it's a different type of game, and you really have to come out of your comfort zone playing over there. And what I mean by that is, I was a post player. When you're a post player in the U.S., you're a post player. You're a four, you're a five. And back when I played, those positions were pretty much defined. But when you go play in Europe, you have to be a little bit of everything. You have to shoot the three. You have to bring the ball down. So it really allowed me to grow as a player. And I would pretty much say those are the highlights from a playing perspective. As far as accomplishments, in 2012, all of those experiences came full circle, and I was inducted into the Chicago Basketball Hall of Fame. So the list is pretty long, Scott. It is pretty long.
So you go from all of that, you know, international player and breaking a lot of barriers and doing some really awesome things, into the world of coaching. Totally different world, but at the same time, I'm sure you had coaches throughout your professional career that shaped the person you are and are becoming, both on and off the court. What's the most important thing for a coach to know to bring the best out of their players, in your estimation?
Wow, that's a wonderful question. In trying to pinpoint one particular thing, I think it's a coach who can really show their player that they care. That's the number. If I had to pinpoint one particular thing, it would be a coach that shows that they care. I had two coaches in particular. My high school coach, who was like my dad, Willie Bird, he passed on. But it was him, and then it was my other coach, Thomas Dobson. They showed they care. And then I would say it has to be a kind of second thing to that with an asterisk by it. They also believed in me. So those two things alone, they never allowed me to settle. They never allowed me to just do enough to get by, just to be. They always pushed me. So every time I accomplished one thing, it was not enough. They pushed me to the next thing. And I would say those are very important for coaches to have, to show you care and really show that you believe in a kid. And that's the start of building a relationship where they trust you to respond to you as a coach.
All right. And so now we're going to get to your charitable organization and all the work you're doing. But before we get there, we got to talk about the other side, the parents. there are supportive parents, and then there are overbearing, my snowflake child can do no wrong parents. So let's educate some people. What's the right way for a parent to encourage their star athlete or hopeful star athlete without becoming overbearing, without going over the top?
Two things. First, parents have to be realistic. That's number one. Like, I can use my own personal experience as an example with my mother. My mother was realistic. She never, I guess what I'm trying to, this one really gets me. She never over-exaggerated the player that I was before I became that player. She supported me as I grew, as I matured, as I became the player that I ultimately became in the sport. So she never over-exaggerated that. And then I think number two, for parents, they have to be able to trust the coach. If you're going to allow your kid to play for a coach, then trust that coach. So if you trust that coach, then you won't cross the line of trying to be the coach and be the parent. So I think those are two things. Be realistic and trust the coach that you allow your kid to play for, and it, you know, that helps.
Let's educate people. Future Hoopers of America, what is it and what's its mission?
Yes. Future Hoopers of America is my organization that I started 7 years ago now. And my purpose behind it was because basically I wanted to give back to kids, because again, those two coaches I mentioned earlier, Willie Bird and Thomas Dobson, they took the time out to help me. So I want to pay that forward and in some way help kids. So that is what my goal is through the organization. And the mission as a whole is teaching on-the-court skills while enhancing off-the-court value. I'm a firm believer that you can learn so many things through sports. And it's not just sports-related, it's life-related. Like, you can learn teamwork, accountability, responsibility, organization. One thing, especially with the times that we're living in, it also teaches you how to embrace diversity. And that helps you grow as a person. And I've experienced that myself. It really is a microcosm of the real world, pretty much. So that's why my mission is what it is for the organization.
So from there, you've kind of sprung off into the Best of the Best Seasonal 60 Showcase. I'm assuming that's tournaments or something of that sort. What's the mission of that project?
Okay, so the Best of the Best Sensational 60 Showcase is my girls basketball event that I run through the organization, and that was kind of created because I've coached so many high-caliber events, but there was always something missing in the sector of girls basketball events that didn't have a level of exclusivity and, you know, that selection, the invitation, the really exclusive aspect to it. So I thought about it. I started with a team event, a really exclusive team event, but it was good. The first one was good, but it did not get the response that I had hoped for. So I kind of branched over into the invitation-only sector for girls. I think back in the day, Nike used to have something like that for girls. So I wanted to bring that back to where, you know, it was the hand-picked kids where you see them, you evaluate them, and you pick the best amongst the best, and they compete against each other. So that is kind of where that idea grew from, because I felt that there was a need for an event like that.
Interesting theoretical questions now, because I'm really curious. How much of the game is competing against other players, and how much of the game is competing against yourself and your personal best?
Let's see. I would say 70% is competing against yourself, because at the end of the day, when you've played in a game, you've played in tournaments, you've played your entire career, the one person that you outdo all the time is yourself. Like you're the measuring stick for yourself, and you control pretty much how well you do or how bad you do, how you respond, how you don't respond. I think the 30% is other people, but if you have your mind and your attitude set to compete at the highest level to accomplish a certain thing, nobody can really stand in your way of that. Like, my mind when I played was that I was the best post player, period. And it didn't always work for me 100% of the time, but it allowed me to go out there and compete at a level to where when I stepped off the floor, whether I won or if I lost, I was still happy with my performance. I left it all on the court, and really competing with yourself, that's really what you aim to get is, did you leave it out there? Did you do your best? And that's where the real satisfaction comes from.
I'm thinking, though, the best still with something to learn from other greats that came before you. Delicate balance, isn't it? The humility to realize that others can do better on any given day, but you have to be at your best when you're on the court. I would think that mental part, still willing to learn, but believing you are the best at what you yourself can do, has to be a delicate dance, no?
Yes, it does. And player you're always learning. You're always learning. But it's like, yeah, you always have to have that thought process. Now, there you're going to step on the floor where there are going to be people better than you. Hands down, there are going to always be people better than you. But if you have that mentality, even if they are and you don't end up winning that battle, it's going to motivate you to go do what you need to do so that next time if you face that person, you're going to be more ready. And that's like, that goes back to what you said about learning and, you know, really taking it in. You, I guess it's, you always, you respect who you play. You never, you know, disrespect or count anybody out. But at the same time, you still maintain who you are and the attitude that you have. So it allows you to compete and learn at the same time.
There is a book forthcoming, hopefully, in 2018. How about we educate our listening audience to that and the type of things contained within the book, give them a title, and the type of things they're going to learn when it's released?
Yes, yes. My book, Recruit Bits, and all of my experience, I noticed so many things that coaches, kids, and parents, like you mentioned earlier, they either don't know or they choose to overlook, or it's just so many different things that go on just in sports period, but particularly youth sports, that I felt the need to share. So my book coming out is Recruit Bits, Tips for Parents, Kids, and Coaches to Navigate the World of Amateur Basketball. And through it, I'm just giving all types of tips for the kids in playing, for the kids when it comes to intangible aspects, for the parents to help them be more realistic as they go through the process, for coaches that might overlook the small things that the kids need to be successful. So right at this point, as of today, I started on January 1st, Scott. So as of today, I am at 870 recruit bids. And again, they're aimed towards parents, kids, and coaches. And sometimes some of them are general, just about the game itself. But I really hope that book can just be a guide and provide them with that particular demographic that I mentioned with insight to the sport, or they might encounter a situation where an AAU coach wants the parent to pay, but the parent is not getting what they're, you know, getting the worth for what they're paying for. So it's just so many little things that I've experienced, that I've seen, that I know of, and I just combine them all into the one book that I'm doing, which is the Recruit Bit.
I'm really curious. I mean, to me, one of the fascinating things about basketball is the cardiovascular endurance to make that game work. You have to either have awesome cardio or you're going to blow up on that floor. Do you have any tips for aspiring players or people who are playing now to get in the best possible cardio shape imaginable?
Yes, I do. And one of my moments in my life in which I was in the best shape ever was when I was at Casper College for 1 year. And the thing that allowed that to happen, and I didn't even know it beforehand, Scott, it was the altitude. Running at an altitude is so great. That's why even now, let's say we're in the Midwest, you don't have the mountains to run on like you do out west on the western part of the country. But I always tell kids, first off, if you're training, try to do something with an incline. That helps tremendously because it's the resistance of the incline. It works your muscles. It really pumps your heart. But I also tell them to do long-distance running because when I was in high school, I ran cross country. That was my preseason sport, per se. So that really helped with being able to go and go, like you said, with the endurance for long periods of time. And then, like, I feel like kids also nowadays just have to do more conditioning work in general. Like, you can play, but playing is not enough, especially with so many kids who want to go on to play collegiate athletics. It's just not enough. You always have to do more. So you really have to combine a lot of different components in order to get to that tip-top shape that you're referring to. You know, you have to put in the incline just to help with the endurance. You have to do the long distance, and you can't cheat and not do the court work because you're doing that work. It's all one recipe for a great meal, pretty much.
I'm curious if anyone's ever taken a Fitbit or other similar style machine and taken it through someone who plays the majority of a game. How many miles somebody runs end-to-end of the court in a 60-minute game? I'd be interested to know what that is, because I got to think you've probably got to put a few miles in during the course of a game, no?
Scott, that is actually ingenious. you're going to have me get one of those and put it on one of the kids and tell them, hey, just wear this. Because, that's something I have never thought about. Because when you're out there, you know you're running. You know you're running a lot. And that would be something pretty interesting to know. Matter of fact, that's something that I would get one of the kids to do. And then I'll get back to you on that answer, because I'm sure it's several miles, not to mention if the game goes into overtime.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, everybody says run, and I got to thinking as you're saying that, well, how much do I need to run? Do I need to run 3 miles? Do I need to run 5 miles? Do I, you know, how much sprint work do I need to do? You know, what's top speed? Like, all these questions come forward, and I don't think anyone's ever dug into that a little bit.
No, and I don't know of anyone that has myself. That's why I said it's really interesting. Maybe that will be, I will give you a credit in the book, and I'll throw that in the book just as a tidbit. Like, hey, do you know you run an average of 7 miles per game? Like, that would be really great.
Yeah, I think that'd be interesting. I'm going to have some fun now. Suppose we handed you a magic wand, and we said you can make one change to the game as a whole. It can't hurt anybody and has to help the maximum number of people. What are you doing? Why?
I would take my magic wand, and I would take the money out of it. And the reason I would take the money out of the sport is because then you filter out who's genuine, who really loves it because of the sport itself, who would continue to help kids if you take the money out of it, who would work just as hard if the money or, you know, the rewards are taken out of it. I would take that part out of it because, I mean, it is a very high-grossing sport. I mean, of course, the girls don't get as much on the financial side as the boys, but it is still present. And I would really take the money out of it because then you'll get to the sincerity. You know, you'll filter out a lot of people, a lot of kids who are doing it for the rewards of it. Like I said, the financial side. And financial is not always monetary. So that's what I would take my magic wand and eliminate from the sport, because it has become tainted in some ways because of that. And I really, truly love the sport for what it is and what it has taught me and what it has, what it has allowed me to mature into as a person and as a woman when you do that. Because then you get back to just the realness, and that's a beautiful thing.
All right. And what do you think? I mean, I know that in the last several years we've seen a rise in coverage of women's athletics, most notably MMA, Ronda Rousey, obviously, one of the highest grossing female athletes of all time with her UFC fights. But what do you think it would take for the mainstream media to level the playing field so that women's athletics gets treated at least on par with men's athletics. How far away do you think that is?
You know, okay, this is my moment to be truly, truly just raw. First off, it would take people being in the decision-making position for programming to first off have a respect for women's sports. Because if you don't respect women's sports or you have no interest in women's sports as a network producer or something, you're not really going to have an interest in putting it on TV or putting it in the mainstream so people can kind of say, hey, what's this? Let me find out more about it. Let me see if I can grow an interest for it. That's number one. Number two, I would say that they have to also just give it a chance. People think, oh, women's sports boring because, again, like we mentioned earlier, the same level of athleticism is not there. The high-flying dunks and spectacular moves aren't there. But I think they just have to really give it a chance and put it out there and not put it out there for a short period of time. Put it out there so that, like with most other things, it will grow on people and people will build a respect for it and build an interest in it. And I would say in terms of a time frame of that happening, as sad as it sounds, I would say we're probably still at least 10 years away before it would even be something that a norm. And I'm not even going to, and that's really, I'm not even going to say equal to the men and the men's exposure for men's sports, but just for it to become something that's normal on television.
And I guess maybe I'm simple-minded here, or maybe it's the fact that I've been around entertainment in one form or another for 20 years, but I can't imagine that there isn't a niche market network for a woman's sports network. First run programming targeted to the female athlete. I would imagine that with 500 to 700 cable channels, there'd be a market and advertisers who would pick that up. First run women's tennis, first run women's basketball, first runs women's boxing and MMA, and have a 24-hour network, almost like an ESPN, that covers that side and targets those advertisers who would want to connect with the aspiring or wishful female athlete. I don't get it.
And you know what, Scott? That is a very, very great idea and an interesting observation. You know they have ESPNW, but I'm not even sure I don't know the ins and outs of that tributary of ESPN, but in my mind, I thought that was supposed to be it per se, but I'm not even sure if it's a channel. I know there's an ESPNW, but I don't know what their programming consists of or anything like that, but I think that would be a great idea because then you would get those people and those followers and those fans and those viewers that love women's sports, respect women's sports, want to see women's sports. I think it would drive viewership, and then you would even get people tuning in that just probably tune in for curiosity, but then it grows on them. I think that would be a phenomenal idea. I think that a sports network as big as ESPN would probably or should probably be the one that would really pick that up and go with it.
In this day and age, with more athletics programs for female athletes in high schools, in middle schools, and in colleges, I think it's a natural evolution in order to have that niche market channel. Or even this way, I mean, to me, there's money on the table for a streaming service, kind of like, you know, the MLB network and kind of like a women's athletics network with a monthly subscription service behind it, and you build it that way. There's got to be something in that.
Yeah, it definitely, yeah. And it's so crazy because I'm going to tell you, one of the things that kind of goes into what we're talking about that really frustrated me was the fact that the Final Four or the tournament, let's put it like this in general, the NCAA tournament for the men, they were playing NCAA games when the tournament started. They had the men's games on, I would say, no less than 7 channels. It was CBS, TBS, ESPN, TNT. They had them on all the channels, and they only had the women's games maybe on ESPN and some other random channel every now and then. And then when they did have those games on, they were like only basically the major program. And I think that's very unfair, which goes back to what you're saying. If they had a dedicated female sports channel, that would be an awesome thing for it, because at least people like myself and many others, I'm sure, would tune in like religiously to see things like that, the Final Four. And then like the WNBA, for example, you can't, like, you have the NBA TV dedicated to NBA games. Some of the WNBA games during the season were coming on at 11 a.m. in the morning, random channels, small channels that, you know, some people have, some people don't have. So it's kind of like they're putting the women's sports, particularly, like, I'm just speaking of basketball right now, they're putting it where they can find space for it versus making space for it like they do the guys' sports. It's unfortunate. It really is.
You're doing a little bit to empower women in all forms, though, with the docuseries project that you're in the middle of. How about we educate some people about that as well?
Yes, yes. I wanted to do this because pretty much just looking back on my life, I have a story to tell. Okay, I didn't play in the WNBA and I'm not a millionaire, but when it relates to the work I've done in my community, in my area, which is really one of the biggest things that matters, I've had a pretty successful journey. The journey has not always been easy by any means, but there's a story to tell behind that. And, like, you know, when I was coaching, you know, the kids would say, oh, Coach D, you know, you're not a regular lady. Like, you're this. And they were really inspired by me. It was really a positive thing, but they only saw and they only knew the end result. They don't know about, you know, the long nights in the gym, the long nights just praying for things to work out. They don't know about the blood, sweat, and tears behind it. And that's what led me to kind of come up with the idea for the documentary, because I'm sure that there are other women out there with stories to tell. And usually you only see the end result. You see the success, but you don't see the journey to that success. And I think that story needs to be told, not only them and them being able to get it out there, and not only for the purpose of empowering other women, but for this next generation of girls. Because, let's just say, in the mainstream media now, they don't have a lot of positive images for girls to see, like, oh, my God, I understand, or something that it's more than them looking at somebody or somebody getting notoriety because of something physically related, you know, how they portray women in the media. So I feel like the documentary would help that next generation understand that there is no blueprint to success. There is no common story. Your journey is your journey. You embrace that journey, and you use it to make you who you ultimately want to become, which is a successful female, so that in years' time, you can turn around and do the same thing for some other little girl.
It's interesting to me. I mean, the narrative we hear in men's sports is, oh, this athlete avoided gang life by getting involved in a sport, or they avoided violence by getting involved in a sport. But we don't hear the story of what young ladies and young women avoid by transferring their energy into a sports career or a sports aspiration? I'm sure as a coach, you've seen that. Have you seen, for example, women with or young girls with self-esteem issues transform themselves or avoid teen pregnancy or avoid other negative behaviors because of their involvement with sports?
Of course. The number one thing, sports is a confidence builder. And when you have, and it's also a self-esteem builder. And when those two things are present, you're less likely to fall to peer pressure, to pressure of your little boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever the preference is. You don't fall under those typical things that I would say a girl who's not involved in sports might or might not fall under. But usually for athletes, they're focused, especially those athletes that want to go to college, their focus is a little bit more straightforward as to what they want to do, so they don't have time for that because they know and learn and understand that those things can be major deterrents to what they ultimately want to achieve. But yes, I've seen girls that have come in with low self-esteem, don't want to stand up straight, don't want to, you know, show that they're confident in themselves, just even physically. And you see them 2 years later, and it's like an entirely different kid. So it just has a way of helping change their perspective, especially, again, when that ultimate goal is college or, you know, just getting something out of it. And I'm not saying that every single one of them who play has a goal to go to college, but they just want to do something that adds to them as people. And sports does that. It really do.
Is there a history of scouting kids too young, in your view? And when is the appropriate time for collegiate scouts to start looking at a kid? I actually have a client in my intervention coaching practice who works with middle school kids. And he said there's people scouting already at that level. And I'm just like, let kids be kids and let them develop as people before we start to say, oh, you're in sixth or seventh grade, let's look at you for college. It doesn't make sense to me.
It's crazy, Scott. It is crazy. I think with the level of competition and the search for the next best thing, you do get some coaches that start early, because especially if that coach is not from a major program that has all the resources, think their intention with starting early is to build relationships early, to build the trust with the kid and the parent early, because once they get, let's say, to high school and the big programs find out about them, then they feel like that would be their greatest asset to competing with those bigger programs, is to have those early relationships, to have that early trust built with the parents themselves and the rest of the family. So, yeah, some of them do start early, particularly, I mean, on the boys' side, that's for sure. I mean, I've seen people, you know, looking at fourth graders and fifth graders, and I'm just like, wow. But on the girl side, it happens, but it doesn't happen that young. But they'll get ideas and, you know, take looks at them in seventh and eighth grade, that's for sure. But I think they start early for the fact of the competition out there is just crazy. It is really crazy.
What's the most common bad habit you see players develop, male or female, doesn't matter, that leads to injuries that they've got to work on before they blow out a knee or blow out an ankle or have issues with spinal alignment? What are some of those bad habits?
Oh my gosh, yes. One of the bad habits that I would say that I noticed versus when I came along, a lot of kids don't do weight training. now like they should. And a lot of coaches do not emphasize it. And weight training and strength training is so important, particularly for female athletes, because it does cut down the risk for injuries, particularly ACL injuries because of the quad strength and things like that. But a lot of people don't focus on that. And people, particularly for girls, let these kids get away with the excuse of, oh, my God, if I lift weights, I'm going to look like a man. No, you're not. And I've told kids that so many times in my life, just like, you have to do this. Trust me, you will be lifting a long time and a lot to even remotely look like that. But you can do it to get your body right, to maintain, to prevent injuries. And that is something that is so often overlooked nowadays, Scott. It's unbelievable. Like, I don't know of a coach that emphasizes strength training. Like, when I was in high school, my high school coach, we had to do it. It was not an option. But now, I don't know what happened.
So, obviously, in male sports, we're seeing in the last, let's call it, decade, 15 years, the prevalence of PEDs, performance-enhancing drugs. Is that culture still present in female sports, or is that less? Are supplements and steroids and things of that nature part of that culture, or is that more male-dominated?
I think that's more male-dominated. I don't have any knowledge of any particular incident or major situation of that happening in women's sports, particularly women's basketball. I think that's more prevalent in men's basketball because of the fact that the competition is so great. And again, it goes back to everybody trying to be in the league. Everybody's trying to get that $1 million contract. On the women's side, it's more just natural. It's like, okay, let me do the work. Let me do what I have to do to make it, but it's definitely not prevalent on the women's side. Now, is it occurring or could be occurring? Possibly. I think if it is on the women's side, it's probably not performance enhancers, but probably just the whole supplemental thing, you know, the proteins and iron supplements and things like that, but definitely not the performance-enhancing drugs.
So, do you think then that we're going to see any major changes in the standards of play, rule changes in the sport, anything like that that's going to change women's sports as it becomes, specifically basketball, as it becomes more mainstream? Or is the game going to be the same in 20 years as it is right now?
The game itself, what and the rules related to the game itself will remain the same, but in terms of recruiting, and this kind of goes back to what we were talking about, like starting too early, I think the recruiting changes will consistently change, and I think it will change to adapt to the times and, you know, the things that cross the NCAA desk of what people are doing and what people are not doing, what people should be doing and they should not doing, you know, all of those things. I think more so the recruiting rules will change versus the actual game rules. I'm really picking my brain to see if there's any possibility of game rule changes. Probably not. Protecting kids more, which I don't really know how much more they can do that in terms of, like, the elbows and concussions and things of that nature. But I don't see too many other rule changes for the women's game occurring, and I'm really thinking about that.
You know, that raises another thing. I know in combat sports, in football, in sports where there's a lot of physical contact, concussions and CTE, a big topic over the last 5 years. Is concussion syndrome an issue in women's basketball, or is that minor? I know that there's some talk that concussions can happen from whiplash now and fast movement, not just the strike of the head against a hard surface. Has that increased at all in your time in the sport?
Oh, yes, it has. And actually, it's so funny you said that because I was at a tournament last week and I was talking to two of my colleagues about how, you know, back in the day, particularly as a post player, we used to be able to get the rebound, square up with our elbows out, not throw the elbows, but we used to be able to pivot with them. And I was asking them, is that still legal? And they were like, well, sort of, yes, sort of, no. And it wasn't really a complete answer to that. They said you kind of got to have your elbows more downward versus outward when I play. And now if you turn and make contact with someone at the, I guess, the neck and head level, then that's like a major foul, flagrant, technical. I think it's flagrant or technical. I can't remember which one. And that's something that has changed tremendously. But when I was playing, it was like it didn't exist. But then all the concussion stuff really wasn't like big time conversation pieces either back then. So I would say that has definitely changed. And then with the whole review process that they have now, I think it's great for the protection of the kids, but at the same time, It's kind of, to me, it slows it down. I mean, the women's game is already slow enough, but when you have to take 2 minutes, 3 minutes to go back to review a play that was inadvertent contact and all those things like that, and then you give a player a flagrant foul for something that was inadvertent, it just really makes the game that much more boring. Like, seriously, I'm just being honest.
Well, and I would think, too, I mean, if you're out there running – and then you stop, let's say, five times during the course of a game for replay calls, and you stop, let's say, 3 minutes on average per call, that would, to me, would heighten injuries of something like a pulled hamstring, a torn MCL, ACL, because you're cooling down and heating up and cooling down and heating up. To
Agreed.
Me, you're trading one potential injury for another.
Agreed. And it's really, I personally don't think that they should get so technical with the calls, especially if it's inadvertent. And it's a contact sport. Like, you know that going in that it's a contact sport. I've had parents tell me, you know, they might take their kids out of it because it's too physical or kids get bumps and bruises. Well, Those are those things that help you grow as a player. I mean, I've had some injuries that were, like, horrific. For example, I was telling a friend of mine, I was playing in a jamboree, and the girl, I don't know how, it was a freak accident, but her tooth, like, went through my top lip. So it's just those things that just make you tougher. It makes you stronger. But now I think it's, you know, with the way things are going, it's taken away from the sport. It's taken away from the teachings that it can give you. It makes you tough for life. Life is not easy. The game should not be as easy as it has been made. So, you know, I'm not a big proponent of all these small things that they've implemented. I'm not at all. I'm kind of old school with this, Scott.
I guess I am too, because my response to that, if you don't want contact, then go play checkers. I don't really quite understand the no contact in a sporting contest. We've got about 5 minutes remaining. I want to give you an opportunity to plug anything you want to, but before we do that, do you have a 1 or 2 minute story of kind of a road story from your time internationally, just to give people a peek into what it's like to be a touring athlete in a foreign country?
Well, first and foremost, I would say one of the biggest things out of my experience in being an international professional basketball player has been the cultural experiences. Like, they are priceless. And that's why now I'm a huge advocate of telling kids and people in general, if you have an opportunity to get out the country, get out the country, because it just broadens your horizon so much more. One of my best experiences was when I was playing in Portugal. It's absolutely beautiful. Like, it is beautiful, but it's business as well. Like, you know, when you're an international player, you think, like, over here in the U.S., you know, as an athlete, you take your time, you take a day. If you're tired, you take a day off. Over there, it's not that. They fly you over there, you get off the plane, you get 2 hours of sleep, you're practicing the same day. But at the same time, they expect you, because, you know, you're an American, they bring you so far over there on their budget, they expect you to perform because they consider Americans the best athletes in the world for the most part. So I think one of the most memorable experiences, and it really is not even basketball, to be honest, I used to go to the restaurant over in Portugal, Madeira, Portugal, which is where I played, and one of the most beautiful experiences, and it's actually one of the experiences that I have that's going to make me go back just for my personal time, was just sitting and at the restaurants that were open to the ocean and watching the transatlantic ocean liners come across. Like, that was one of the most beautiful things in the world, but it also really allowed me to see just how blessed I am and how beautiful the world can be if, you know, you just take time and enjoy the small things and open your eyes and, you know, just embrace moments and embrace opportunities. I would say that would probably be one of my most memorable experiences, like just something so small but yet so big.
All right. So with about a minute or two left here, I want to give you the opportunity to get people your contact information if they've liked this interview and they want to take this into a way to get in contact with you. How would they go about doing that?
Yes. I can be reached by email at bestofthebest, G as in girl, B as in boy, showcase, bestofthebest, GB showcase, at gmail.com, or by phone at 773-744-0985. Again, that's 773-744-0985. Actually, two things that I'm looking for now are, one, for the documentary, I'll start with that, Scott. I'm looking for additional women to interview for the documentary who have been successful in basically the four major industries of sports, entertainment, business, and fashion, beauty, that industry. But I would really appreciate it if, you know a female or you are a female who has been successful and would like to be one of my interviews for the documentary. And then secondly, for the event, to continue the success of the event, I would love it if you know, we're always interested in sponsorship opportunities for people to become sponsors or donors for the event. So far, it has been responsible for over 100 kids getting scholarships and scholarship offers, and we would really like to grow that pretty much because it speaks for itself. So that's where my heart is, that's where my time is, my energy, and I would love to really engage with people who want to help advance that initiative.
All right. Thank you, Dejanette, for your time today. We've got about 60 seconds remaining. I want to give everybody a shout-out for listening live. And also, you can go back in the archive, over 365 shows on this network, over 100 on the Pro Wrestling and MMA network, so literally close to 500 shows. Going to be something you're going to like in there. This is Scott Golden reminding you, keep your feet on the ground, your mind in the moment. Until next time, everybody.